Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbole.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to a live and in living color broadcast of Strictly Confidential. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 140. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, right here, exclusively, on listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by CRMW.net and have a look and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, today being Friday, May 2nd, 2008. And again, if you were listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Friday, May the 2nd of 2008, you're indeed listening to a live show. And you're welcome to call in and participate with both myself and the guest, whom we'll be introducing shortly. I will give out the telephone numbers shortly also. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. And there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the past shows. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active. And Friday evening's a good night to stop by and join up. It's very easy. You just click on the chat link located at the strictlyconfidentialradio.com page. And you give yourself a username, and you sign in. It's just that simple. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and links there to help you locate the music you hear on the show. You'll find there also a link to Head On Radio Network's main site, where there are listings for all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I'm only a small part. You'll find links there to the PayPal buttons that will also make it very easy for you to help support Progressive Radio and keep the Head On Radio Network, well, passing packets and fans turning and drive spinning and all the things that the Head On Radio Network has to do in order to bring you a live show. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366. Again, toll-free, 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that, and you'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. And either way, we're glad to take the charges and the call. But if you do have unlimited long distance, use 304-658-3333. That is area code 304. 658-3333, and it rings in West Virginia. Will be answered by either Agnes or Bob. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. Again, that's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. So you have three ways to participate: via the chat room, via the toll line, or the toll-free line, or by email. I told you the story last evening of what my morning was like Thursday morning. I got up with a heavy heart, knowing that at some point during the week I had to find out what was going on with the Bush Library. I'm being parked at Southern Methodist University. I got up early yesterday morning and couldn't find any news about it, so I didn't know what was going on. I found one article boldly stating that the library is going to be there, with no reference to the fact that the Methodist Church was voting or had voted. So I waited to a reasonable hour in the morning, around 9:30, maybe 10, to call Reverend Andrew Weaver. Now, if you recall, Mr. Weaver has been on the show before, and Mr. Weaver is the fellow who single-handedly put together the petition to stop the George Bush presidential bookshelf and the associated right-wing think tank from being placed at Southern Methodist University. And he was definitely the man to ask, and I must have dialed the number four or five times, picking it up and dialing it all the way up to the last digit, then I would hang up again, because basically I've become to expect bad news to the point, and I just didn't want to hear the answer. I was convinced in my heart that it was all go for the resident idiot to have a library there. But I told Andrew he'd answer the phone. I said, Andrew, I really hated to call you this morning. He said, why? And I said, well, the library, what's going on with the library? And he gave me some wonderful news, which apparently is spreading around the media rather quickly. And Andrew has the inside scoop. And with no further ado, Mr. Weaver, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Good to be with you.
Hi, Andrew. Well. Yes, sir. I am well. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes. If there are any changes in that, just let us know. And the studio has plenty of knobs and buttons and sliders they can adjust to fix that right up.
Okay.
Andrew, what a mess. What a mess. The media seems to have reported that it was all over. The votes were given out, and now it seems the media is falling all over itself to say it's really not over yet. What really happened there, Andrew?
Well, each 4 years, the United Methodists, which are church international of about 9 million members, together about 1,000 delegates to the ultimate body in the church. And God bless her, woman in a church in Greenville, South Carolina, wrote a petition to Congress, as as one can do, saying that we don't want to have any part of George Bush's library, that we don't want to lease him land or sell him land. And she was quite humorous. She said she thought Texas was big enough he could find another spot.
You'd take
And it was just, you know, a straightforward human appeal that the good Methodist people should not be have this albatross around their neck in perpetuity. Well, when it went to the committee, there's about 55 members of the committee that oversees legislation dealing with higher education. So you're talking about the intelligentsia, you know, the deans, the presidents, the people who are responsible in over the 123 schools the Methodists have in this country. They voted, I think it was 51-5, that the legislation should go and be dealt with by the South Central jurisdiction that owns the land. The truth is, they could have killed it forthwith, and a lot of legislation like this is killed, but they didn't do that, which is the first sign that definitely there's a willingness in the church to have a discussion, because the bishops in Scott Jones, who's a bishop in Kansas, as repeatedly said in the press, and has been sadly backed up by other bishops who know better in that area, that there will not be another vote, that this is a fait accompli. What this does, the short version is, I'm a preacher, so there's not short versions, Peter, sorry.
No, we appreciate the in-depth. We like that here. There's plenty of time.
Then it went to the full membership, and basically it was saying that this should be forwarded to the South Central jurisdiction to have a debate, which was a huge breakthrough, because they've been saying it's over, it's a fait accompli, there will be no such debate, in spite of the fact that the Constitution of the United Methodist Church says explicitly that there should be debate in the right of these people to vote. So that alone was elating. This this recommendation now goes to the South Central jurisdiction. And it is not the end of it, but it certainly, we believe we can win today. That's the bottom line, Peter. We believe we've got the votes to win today if we are given the right to vote. And we've been looking at trying to go to court to do this, a civil court, which we don't want to do. We've been doing everything possible, but it is the judgment of no matter what SMU says or others, the judgment that the pressure is now on for these people to open up the process. One other item, if there had been an attempt to kill this, it's telling to me that when it went to the floor, nobody stood up. You don't need one person with a second to say, you know, we're embarrassing the president, we shouldn't do this, you know, he's got a very, you know, nice family, la, la, la. Nobody stood up to do that, to defend him, because I think they knew they didn't want a debate in the United Methodist Church on this and at that level, and B, they knew darn well they'd lose. So that is basically where it comes out as. It makes it much more hopeful, Peter, that the door is open. In fact, the President of the United States today in Missoula actually appears to have responded to the Methodist Church indirectly.
Really?
Yes. There's a piece in the Dallas Morning News. It came out at 5:37 p.m. Friday today. President touts planned library at SMU. He was in Missoula, and he spontaneously appears made a comment how his library will promote freedom, in the Orwellian sense that he means freedom means slavery, brushing aside critics who say it will operate as a partisan venue. I can't help believe that that is a direct result to his people telling him you better react to what the Methodists have done and not let it go. Because he rarely comments about these things.
Yeah.
The president took questions from employees at a plant in suburban St. Louis. I'm reading off the Dallas Morning News piece. He said that there would be a freedom agenda. We're going to have it's going to be very important to be kept in the forefront of American philosophical thought. I'm sorry. I'm like, this guy too long. This is unbelievable.
Well,
so the truth of the matter is that's where we are. We still need the help of the people. We need as big a petition as we can to put as much pressure on the bishops in that area to have a vote. We've counted the votes. We believe we have a very strong chance to beat. The sentiment, Peter, is really against the partisan institute. Karl Rove is the guy planning it. Now, a guy who lost 5 million emails, do you think he's going to be a trusted person to be able to tell us what happened in the White House?
Well, precisely.
This is the guy who is, according to U.S. News and World Report, is, quote, planning, fundraising, and designing this thing. And so you've got Karl Rove basically putting together a disinformation center over which they have talked about $500 million, but Peter, there's no oversight. They could spend $10 billion doing this. The blood money that has been made from war profiteering just on the trustees themselves at SMU is in the billions.
Wow.
The $35 million was given by Ray Hunt towards this project, who is a Halliburton key player on the trustees. Ray Hunt, his wealth, Peter, between the beginning of the war, is a very close old friend of George Bush and his father, and George Sr. His wealth went, according to Forbes, in 2003 from $2.3 billion to $4 billion. And that money comes from the blood of our soldiers who have died in a complete travesty. So talking about, you know, the old hymn being washed in the blood, this thing is going to be built by people who have blood on their hands and all over them.
Yes, I was very disturbed.
Sorry?
I was just saying that, I was very disturbed when I discovered late in the game that Mr. Hunt is actually one of the Board of Regents for Southern Methodist University. I had no idea the Board of Regents stank to high heavens. People who attend White House parties, people who... Yeah, go ahead.
Peter was completely packed. This whole thing was a ruse to get this partisan institute. The library, they could give a hoot. They're not about to tell you anything that they think will look like George Bush and his cohorts or anything except, saints. This is, and the trustees have been packed over since he got in the White House, and you can track it, who got on it. One of the things that's just pretty near laughable is the liaison committee between the trustees and the White House that negotiated this was made up of Ray Hunt's vice president, who managed, who again is involved with long term with George Bush, a guy named Boone, who is one of the, I think he's the 8th or 13th highest contributor to George Bush's campaigns. And it goes on and on and on. The interests of Southern Methodist University and the United Methodist Church were never on the table. The only interest that's ever been here is giving the school over to George Bush.
That's what it comes down to. To really just hand it over. That's precisely the terminology that I've been using and we've been thinking. You're basically selling the good name of the Methodist Church.
You are. And the tragedy here is, many colleagues of mine and I have written the bishops directly. Scott Jones in Kansas has said repeatedly he thinks that George W. Bush is a faithful Methodist. So I wrote him and asked him, dear Bishop, if international kidnapping and torture of tens of thousands of people by your surrogates in this country and elsewhere is not enough to question his faithfulness to Christ, what criteria are you using?
Did he respond?
I did not get a response to that. But many people who have asked just straight out at a general conference, the bishops there, and these people have written me, said they get bureaucratic answers. It's tragic. You know, this is, one can only come to the conclusion this is about money and power. And the last time there was a moral test for a Methodist like this, Peter, was slavery. In the 1840s, before the Civil War, there were some bishops in the South arguing that slavery was compatible with the Christian religion. That's why we broke apart before the Civil War and didn't come back together as a church until the 1930s because of that immorality. And it's the same propensity. God love it, but, if the church gets to the point it stands for nothing, then it stands for nothing. We shouldn't stand with it. And my feeling here is this is a moral crisis in this church. I think if they don't open it up to a vote, this will be a scandal in the church that will stink to high heaven forever.
Well, I completely agree.
It's been a long time.
Yes, and we were echoing those feelings last evening. The church makes progress in so many different ways, slowly, 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 but this is a permanent tarnish that I don't think history could ever wipe out. As historians look back, Lord, it's going to be cruel. Andrew, what we have a segment that runs after Strictly Confidential from 11 till 12, and it's where the hosts get together and we talk about what's going on during the day. One of the things that came up and we discussed last night during that section following this show was how the Bush crime family and Rove is going to attempt to work around this and, in other words, to either prevent the vote or shift the vote. And because of the high-level connections between the Board of Regents and the Bush administration and the huge amount of money that's involved, what do you see happening between now and July that could sway this in the other direction? Or even, one of the things that came up, could they insist that this has to be handled handled differently, or by a court because of contractual issues by a court of the United States versus the Methodist jurisdiction. What's up? We're so afraid they're going to work around it. They always do. There's always a back door of these people. We're very concerned.
Well, it is very telling to me that the president responded this rapidly, that he is really afraid. That the Methodist Church really does, brother, own that university lock, stock, and barrel. And if they pass it in a vote and say no, he can't use it. And this is now what can be done is to apply as much of the power, the will of the people. You know, these churches are volunteer organizations. If the people don't go with them, they stand alone. And I can tell you, when this story came out, I literally got dozens and dozens of people writing me thank you notes saying, God, I thought my school was over. I mean, the sentiment against this is so intense. If it can be enlivened and focused through people like you who have a larger voice, and they need to sign the petition at www.protectsmu.org. Anybody of conscience, you don't need to be a Methodist. It's nice to have the Methodist, but anybody of conscience can sign that petition and let the will of the people, in my opinion, a million people would sign it if they knew it existed. I mean, this president now, what, has an approval level of 27%, the lowest in the history of polls? People are fed up with him. And what can be done also is you don't actually need half of the delegates, so the 290 to vote. If there is a vote, I believe we'll take it down, but if only one-third of them say we want this to go to the court of the Methodist Church, this thing is being done in such a way it's breached the Constitution of the Methodist Church at several levels. The bishop's interference in this is a breach of the powers of between the legislative branches, which in this case, the General Conference, and I won't go into details, but I'm absolutely sure that a ruling by the court now, because it's full of liberals and moderates, are rational people, that we would win on that too. The other venue is the court, and for the court, you need a delegate to be a party of a lawsuit. And the delegates have been intimidated so much by the fear, particularly the clergy, of their future. There's so much at stake, and we don't understand what the promise, nobody knows what's been promised, but I think that it's unpleasant to say it, but I believe things have been promised from wealthy, powerful people, and we've got a factor of intimidation in this. Your version is that petition is powerful, the will of the people, and George Bush, the last thing he wants is to have the United Methodist Church impeach him over this, because really this is saying to the world, we don't accept him as a Christian. We don't want to honor him in this way. And that's a very deep indictment, and it's one that he deserves. I think torturing human beings, Brother Peter, and doing wars of aggression against innocent people are war crimes. And that, I believe, that's not a guess. When you look at and ask people their opinions, much of the world sees this man as an authoritarian bully. So,
well, I completely agree. We're wondering, too.
In practical terms, and I apologize, is that there needs to continue to be pressure that this vote is not meaningless, that the General Conference could have easily voted it down, but there was no way in the world that the SMU people who were in that building, including Scott Jones, wanted there to have any public discussion of it. Therefore, they let it ride. And they knew darn well that they didn't want a discussion in General Conference, or they'd have brought it up to try to take it down. And they also knew that it was probable they'd lose.
I see.
Like, all of these things are to say there's still some Christians in the Methodist Church, and as long as they're willing to fight, I am.
Well, I am too. Now, these 290 people in the Southern Jurisdictional Council, I believe you're calling it, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. These 290 people, you're saying it would take only one-third of them to then refer it to the highest Methodist court? Is we're still talking about another Methodist court over this one?
Well, you know, the Methodists were founded about the same time as the Republic in 1789, and their pattern of governance is like the Republic itself. There's a court branch, there's a legislative branch, and then the executive branch are the bishops. And so you've got a constitution that gives the right to the court to rule on this matter. So one-third of the vote would rule on the constitutionality of them blocking a vote, which is ridiculous. They'd never win that argument. But if we got half the votes, they would just say, excuse me, but we don't want you to use our land. That's it.
Now, the higher court would have no authority.
I can't imagine. I apologize.
No problem. It's just there's so many things we've talked about and want to know all at once. So if that were to occur the way you just described, then the higher court within the Methodist Church could not intervene. Is that right?
No, sir. The highest court could say this is not a democratic process, it's unconstitutional, and you must vote. In other words, they could go to court and force the vote. But all of this is predicated upon there being a willingness for the bishops that day because they're going to be the people up there managing this. It has to do with just how mad the Methodist people are about it. If there's a firestorm about it, these bishops listen to political ups and downs like anyone else. You've got to create a firestorm on the argument that you have no right whatsoever to tell the representatives of the owners of this property that have built this school in 1911 and maintained it through this almost 100 years, they have a right to vote on their own land. That's what it comes down to.
I see. Well, the makeup. Go ahead, please.
I mean, it has to do with private property. And you can imagine in Texas, they have some of the strongest private property laws there are.
Well, the makeup of these 290, I've heard from you that many of these 290 actually voted on the decision of 844 to 20. So we know that many of them lean against it. What about the makeup of, let me put it like this, for so long, 8 years to be exact, in this country we have been completely ignored by all of the courts. What say you about the fidelity of the bishops to the feeling of the church?
Listen, if the court rules against the bishops, there is no way in the world they can do otherwise. And right now, we just elected a general conference. God bless them. We got rid of the people who were right-wingers. And this was a very positive thing the Methodist Church did. And so now we have got real, rational people of integrity. I have no doubt whatsoever that a reasonable, rational decision would be made by that court. I know the people, and I know people who know them. And that, you know, that was the biggest positive that happened there. It's just to say that 145 of the people who will vote of the 290 in July were delegates to that convention. So the fact that only 20 people objected to this and didn't stand up tells me there are a lot of people who. Well, I know for sure. I've talked to dozens of people, even conservatives. So the idea that somehow it's going to be Florida, too, and we're going to stop counting the votes in the middle of this is absurd. It's absurd.
Well, Mr. Weaver,
I'm sorry, this is a massive lesson in Methodist policy and structure.
Well, we're up for it, and I'm glad you're doing it for us. We all of us, Methodist and not Methodist, amongst the listeners, desperately want George to be defeated in this. One of the chatters has posted the article from the Dallas blog Pegasus News, which I know you've read it, and most all of us have read it, which points out that it's referred to the South Central jurisdiction, but it also points out that the jurisdiction's mission council gave SMU permission in 07, in March of 07, to lease part of is this going to be construed by the church as a,
well,
as How's that going to balance out? Thank you.
Well, no, Peter. I was in that meeting that day. I flew to Dallas with my wife, who's also a United Methodist clergy and a lawyer, and we were there. That was a big fix. We tried to advocate for weeks beforehand with the people. We were, even in the end, couldn't find out the total list of people eligible to vote. There were two bishops in the room. One of the bishops, Crutchfield of Arkansas, had a pastor who was under his charge, and they refused to have a secret ballot when it was called upon. I mean, the manipulation of that executive group. What they're proposing here, Peter, is that the biggest decision in the history of this university that is opposed by literally thousands of their alumni who have signed a petition against it and like me all the time, that's the biggest decision is it would come down to a vote of 10-4 that you're going to exclude the 290 people and say this executive committee. And the answer, Peter, literally, when bishops were asked at General Conference, and it's just too cumbersome to do it otherwise. Democracy's cumbersome, excuse me. You know, the Constitution of the United Methodist Church, I mean, George Bush is showing, if he had any integrity, he'd step up to the plate and say there ought to be a vote. Because he has no more respect for the Constitution of the United Methodist Church than he does the United States Constitution.
Well said. That point had not occurred to me. Well said. If he had an ounce of integrity, he would want the church to speak its mind and to be part of the process.
Absolutely. If he had a grain of decency in him at all, why in the heck go split your church? Because if there isn't a vote, Peter, and I've had bishops who retired. Now, the active bishops haven't spoken to them, but they haven't shown a tremendous amount of spine. But the retired bishops, many of them are troubled deeply and have said explicitly that this is going to leave a bitterness and distrust and suspicion, because by circumventing what they know the church knows to be the rules of the church, what does it do? You undermine fundamental ability to work together. And this is no peripheral matter. The Don Evans, who is a longtime buddy of George going back to Midlands, was the Secretary of Commerce, primary fundraiser for this. When this was announced on February the 22nd, he had the gall to stand up and say, this is going to be a place where we celebrate this great Christian. I'm like, great president and his presidency. Now, they're claiming this is a partisan. George Bush is claiming in the paper this is a nonpartisan place where we all get together and, you know, just celebrate goodness. When what this is a temple to a man who has had utter disdain for the Christian religion. Nobody in modern history has done more damage to the ability of the Christians to say anything else to anybody than George Bush and Dick Cheney, who both claim membership in the Methodist Church. This is a moral crisis for the Methodists. And people are going to have utter contempt for the Methodist Church if they don't stand up on their back legs and do the right thing.
Well, Mr. Weaver, a question has come up about earlier you indicated that we, in fact, don't know what was promised to, apparently that was all done behind closed doors. Do you foresee that this could spill over into the regular United States or state of Texas, but not church courts, but because of breach of contract or breach of promise? I'm wondering how much control the church is. I guess I'm getting at separation of church and state. How real is that when it comes to court?
Well, there is a reluctance, of course, of civil courts to ever engage in telling what churches what to do, which in many ways, Peter, makes sense. The separation is real. However, in this case, the laws, because there's a team of lawyers who worked on this, in this case, the property laws overlap in this case. If we had one delegate of the 290 who would step up as a plaintiff, we've got the money to go to court today. And these people have been intimidated. I've been told by a whole bunch of them that if they do this, they feel that retribution will come their way in their life. Now, you know, and I'm old enough. I don't ask people to walk on water. You can't get somebody into something that. But I pray to God that somebody would step up, because we took this to court, and the civil courts got involved. There wouldn't be any ifs, ands, or buts about there being a vote. Then the law becomes a part of it. What we're into now is the power of the people to persuade people to do the right thing. But if you can't, brother, get people to do the right thing by grace, you need the law. You understand? Oh.
Yes, I do. In fact, I have... Please go ahead.
I don't know, Peter. What did you want to ask?
Well, I just wanted to tell you that a huge smile came over my face when you used the word retribution. For so long, the right-wing Christians, quote, Christians, have indicated that retribution comes very quickly and very swiftly to all things liberal. And just to hear the term retribution as applied to the Bush crime family causes one that's great. In fact, I've almost lost that concept that there could be retribution towards those.
Well, one of the things to me, Peter, that's powerful about the Christian religion and, you know, the great religions, not just Christianity, that we're accountable for our lives. You know, that this is, certainly Christianity, this isn't some game we're playing or a hobby for our entertainment. We are our brother and sister's keeper. And when somebody's being tortured at one time, and today, yeah, it made me weep, you know? Man, 6.5 years in the custody of the American government without a charge. I mean, what in the world? What a shame to our ancestors. You don't have to be a Christian to see that as barbarian.
Yes,
I mean, there is no way in hell I'd ever shut up. You know, I'm a follower of Dr. King.
Six and a half years.
You know, well, I mean, suppose that was your brother. He is our brother. That's the thing of it. We actually believe it. He is. And if for George Bush, who is, you know, basically Nero on a mountain bike, and Caligula, Dick Cheney, who appears to do anything for power, and these people act, you know, and to dare any bishop in the Methodist Church to act like this is normal times is ludicrous.
I agree. I completely agree. Mr. Weaver, go ahead, please.
What do you do when you smell fascism in the air? You fight it. You know, my father was wounded fighting the Nazis. My father-in-law flew 113 missions as a fighter pilot across Nazi Europe. There is no way in hell I'll give up.
Oh,
you know,
you're neither.
We fight to the end. And, you know, you have some fun along the way with some music, but you know, 6.5 years to hold a human being in basically what was a torture situation. And for people to, you know, the government act like that's normal behavior, you know.
Yeah.
We haven't done anything to human beings since we incarcerated the Japanese on the West Coast. And even in those conditions, they had enough humanity that they had their families. And what did this guy do? He was a reporter for a news service. I mean, I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. I am proud to have you as a fellow Methodist, and the depth of your feeling impresses not just me, but all of the listeners. I wanted to tell you that we have a caller online that would like, it's Gene. He's one of our regular listeners. He'd like to talk to you. Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Mr. Weir.
Hi, Gene.
Or is it Reverend Weir? I'm sorry.
Andrew Works. Yeah.
I apologize. I'm just curious, and you might have already covered this, but seeing that even though he's at that point be assuming...
Gene, I can't quite hear you, so say it a little bit louder, please.
All right, I'm sorry. Assuming that he Lee's office in 09, because
right.
he was a former president, wouldn't you have some issues with Turkey state and the U.S. Constitution as far as having a presidential
yeah.
library associated
yeah.
with a religion?
Well, you know, that's something actually, one line of reasoning, because we got together lawyers and also some, you know, some professors of constitutional history trying to figure out which way to go, experts. And that, as it turns out, is not a solid argument to make. I can't
okay.
honestly now remember all the nuance in it. But when, I suspect what it is, when he becomes a private citizen, which he does become, but I'm not clear. What I do remember was the laws on property and the laws of breach of fiduciary duty by the trustees. Those were the sorts of things that were the issues that came up with. I think that he clearly, in many ways, has breached this matter of church and state by promoting certain aspects of religion in this country, and has done it at a level that's quite dangerous. Our forebears, who are founders of this country, knew well that the passions are something that you need to manage, and one of the great passions, of course, is religion. And if it becomes too zealous and out of control, you've got to have structures. That's why church and state so important. As
mm-hmm.
separation of them.
The other question that I have, then, I mean, if the thing, I understand it's a library and a think tank he wants to put on there?
And a museum.
Oh, it's a museum, but it's not a think tank.
Well, no, the partisan, what he wants to put up is what he calls a policy institute, but what it's going to be, given that Rove is running it, is it'll be a political operation.
Well,
try to rewrite history. It's going to be a neoconservative think tank in which he is going to have huge amounts of money to buy anybody he wants to write lies about what happened the last 8 years.
Well, yeah, and I'm assuming under that case, because it is political and kind of, that's awful
yeah,
close to
I see
to
your
that
point.
Church,
I see your point.
That
yeah.
church and state issue. I mean, the library, you might be able to say he's a private citizen, yeah, but the institute.
I see your point.
I mean, that's a pretty close one.
if they do start doing that, and for some reason they get away with this, you're right. At some point, it may breach it so somebody could bring them to court.
Okay.
And you may be right on that. There are no boundaries in these people. And there will never be any boundaries. This guy is way too narcissistic. He has no respect for anybody else's. You're right. They make
well,
it to the place they breach it. Legally, I don't know.
The reason I was asking this is I was actually thinking of putting your Protect SMU site up to a bunch of other people that happen to be atheists, but they might sign for the church and state issue. So. That's why I thought it passed. Thank
well,
you.
Appreciate it. We left it as open as possible. We just use the word as unacceptable. So basically, you're right. People have explicitly said they feel this is a breach of church and state in the petition. And people can sign and write about their motivation, and many people have. We've left it open because people have various passions and reasons for doing it. But I think your point's a good one. I mean, if they just ride right on doing this, they may breach. What I want to do is stop it before it ever grows out of the ground.
Thank you. I'll see
Thank
you soon.
Bye.
Thank you, Gene. Reverend Reaver, that was Gene from the state of Oregon. It comes up in
Thank
production
you.
Chat also that the Institute would seem to perhaps violate Southern Methodist University's 501c3 status.
That has been also something people have brought up in terms of that, and honestly, I'm not a big enough legal expert in this to know. You know, it's just not my expertise. Maybe there are attorneys who want to go after this case. Maybe people can go to the federal courts in their own state and challenge it. I mean, there are people so upset and they're people, you know, with legal expertise, I'd say go after them every way you think makes sense.
Well said. Most of our listeners know what a 501c3 is, but in case someone doesn't, that means your nonprofit status, which makes you tax exempt. Another thing that has come up.
But one last thing. You know who one of the head lawyers is? Is Harriet Myers for them, who is now, of course, under indictment by the United States Congress.
One has to shake one's head to even conceive of an organization or a family or a system so corrupt as to accommodate the Bush family without public outrage and pitchforks charging at the door. Another question that's come up is regarding the IRD. It would seem to me that the IRD would love to see the Methodist Church split. Do you see any possibility of a sort of a 50-50 battle thing that might result in that, or what are your thoughts about the church splitting again over this?
There are certain moral questions. Slavery is certainly one of them. You can't abide that. I think torture is the moral equivalent. The question as to Institute on Religion and Democracy, which is a think tank in D.C. that works against, you know, all these mainline churches and funded by SCAFE and so forth. They want to take over these institutions. They really want United Methodist Church to be Southern Baptist Church too, allied to the right wing of the Republican Party. To give you an idea, there's $50 billion in assets alone, just the churches and parsonages. That's not the assets of the 123 schools we own, ISMU, or the hundreds of billions of dollars in pension funds. And if they got a majority vote, and took over, say, the Methodist, Episcopal, Lutheran, these churches, the consequence to the life of the Republic would be dire. Because these institutions are really whole of center to a great extent. There's a joke in the Methodist Church that the Methodists are the extreme center of society. And these mainline churches that make up about 35 million people do have a positive role in holding together as long as they don't completely undermine their, you know, integrity. This is one of the reasons I fought this so hard. You want to try to get the church a voice to make a difference. But short version is IRD is really more interested in taking it over. If they can destroy the church, that's all in good. But this is just the same political maneuver that they did with the Southern Baptist Church. And SCAFE, why in the SCAFE point of view and Coors and Bradley and the rest of these right-wing foundations that fund this is outside money. It's not Methodist money that is turning this stuff up at IRD. It's outside money. And their political motives are to do anything they can to destroy these institutions who have had great effects in many ways on the good of the Republic. I mean, the United Methodist Church and the Lutherans and the Presbyterians and the rest were at the very center of the civil rights movement, many of them. Many of them didn't do the right thing, but many of them did. And so the political consequence, one of the reasons that I think it's important to fight for me, for the United Methodist Church, and not leave it, although sometimes it's so painful, you wonder you didn't do the damn thing, what they're doing. But these institutions, if they are allowed to become right-wing, Peter, what that portends for the life of the Republic is scary.
Well, yes, it is. The influence of the church, you can't really say it's the church, it's the anti-church, would become almost unmanageable. That would be the second largest Protestant denomination to fall.
Yep. And it's a very different fall. Now, the truth of the matter is that is not a likely thing that I see happening. However, if the progressives in the church get so disgusted with it, and many of them have, and you know, joined the United Church of Christ or some other place they can feel like they can live with, and this is where they use the gay and lesbian question, is there's a subset of bigots in the Methodist Church that were bigots against blacks, bigots against women, and now they've just transferred all of malice over to gay and lesbian folks and want to put them on the cross. And there's an element in our church, and it's tragic, but they're also manipulating the African church and the Third World church, who we, of course, taught this bigotry. I mean, in Hawaii, for instance, there was never any bigotry toward, as I understand, gay and lesbian folks in that community until the missionaries came in and told them it was wrong. So what you've got is a fight that's worth fighting. One place, if you want to make a stand, stay in these churches and fight with the right wing. If they take over these institutions, I can't see any single thing institutionally in this country that would be more dire. And there's a point at which I couldn't bear it. But, you know, there's a petition, Brother Peter, out there with almost 12,000 names on it, full of people that are written with passion about what they feel. And there's a lot of good people in this country that wanted to, most of the people are. If the poll said, Peter, that they thought this point that George Bush's presidency had been successful, then you and I would need to wear sackcloth and ashes. I mean, that's a positive thing that his ratings are at the bottom of the bottom. You know, the American people have an innate good sense, and sometimes they're slow to get there. But, you know, this guy is going to leave office under great humiliation.
I'd like to point out to the listeners, we're posting the link to sign the petition in the chat room, and you do not, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Weaver, I don't think I am, you do not have to be a Methodist to sign this petition.
No.
Yes, and it is at W... Go ahead.
I apologize. Yeah, no, I'm no. saying initially we set it up that way because we thought that would gain the attention of the church. There are 29 bishops who signed this in the United Methodist Church. And to get those 29 bishops was a remarkable thing. They don't want any part of it.
So then any of our listeners can sign.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
the
please.
The link is www.protectfmu.org. And that petition will be sent to the president of the United Methodist Bishops in full for the July meeting. And he's an African-American man who's just been elected, named Bishop Palmer in Iowa. And he has been through the civil rights movement. I've talked to other African-American leaders in that church. That guy's got a conscience. And, you know, these are people who know what it's like to have the boot on their neck. And you keep persisting in trying to do the right thing. You never know that's our duty, is just keep persisting.
Well, Andrew, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your showing us the heart of the church this evening, your depth of feeling about this, and of course it brings tears to my eyes, is a breath of fresh air. So many times we talk about the church and it gets political, it gets argumentative, and who believes this and who believes that. Tonight you showed us the heart of the church, and that's invaluable. What you did this evening makes me very proud.
Well, I do think Dr. King's words are, to be a good human being as well as a Christian, you need a hard head and a soft heart. And you persist. The spirit is always moving towards what's right and good. You know, the spirit's like a nudge, Peter. It's constantly gently shoving us towards what's right. And I heard a guy recently say that it's like having a seesaw with a ton of weight on one end and a basket full of sand. And each of us has to come along and take a teaspoon of sand and put it in that basket, and eventually that the weight will be overcome on the other end. But each of us has to do our duty, even if it's a teaspoon.
Well, you've given us great hope. Thank you. You've given us great hope this evening that this will indeed be over in July, and I pray that it will. It is One thing that occurred to me toward the end, Andrew, was that the mainstream media will surgically not bring this up. They will fall all over themselves not to bring this up on the ABCs and CBSs. I could practically guarantee it.
Yeah. Well, the corporate media serves itself, and those are very strong forces. However, they too are functions of the marketplace. But, you know, it's just like in the early days of the Republic. We're all doing what we can in our ways to try to see if we can do the right thing. But it is easy to become cynical and bitter. That's the great test. Those are spiritual questions. Your anger can eat away at you at the point that you just want to give up and say, as Job's wife suggested to him, curse God and die. I think everybody feels that sometimes. But, you know, there's also tremendous heroics, people of great courage. And there are a lot of young and gay and lesbian folks in my church who will stand up with great dignity. Sorry. I mean, in many ways, Peter, the spiritual center of the United Methodist Church now is the gay and lesbian community, as it was in the black community 30 years ago. So,
wow.
Spirit will do as it will.
Well, Mr. Weaver, Andrew Weaver, you have been a remarkable guest. I'm not often left speechless by guests, but you did it to me, and I'm deeply grateful for your being on this show.
Well, Peter and the Bible were brothers, so someday we may meet on this side of Jordan or the other one.
Well, I sure hope so. Thank you, and we would love to have you back again. We'll be in touch.
Anytime. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Good evening. Wow. That was hard for me to keep between the lines. So much of what he told us was so deeply personal to me, and I know when he began discussing the issue of torture, it was deeply personal to you, too. And speaking of the LGBT community, that was brought up at the conference, too. You'll notice this is LGBT Conversation Radio, but I really haven't brought that up because, to me, the library at Southern Methodist University is such a whore of Babylon issue to me that what the Methodist Church did about gay marriage was purely beside the point. Not completely, of course, but certainly a sub-issue to the Bush Library. And the Methodist Church basically decided to keep the same rules for the next, until the next conference that comes up. Basically, it's that... I have the Book of Discipline here, actually they print from it, but pretty much that gay marriage is incompatible with Christian teaching, but that LGBT folks can be fully involved with the church and can take communion and can go on the picnics and fully participate in every way, but we've tabled any decision on that for at least another 4 years is pretty much the decision there. The Methodist Church, like other churches, will eventually come around to the right decision there, but it's like the Bush Library is a fire, and the marriage issue was secondary, at least to me. Hell, I've never been able to get married, so, you know, it's not like, how could you miss what you've never had, you know? So, in any case, where were we? Yes, it's top of the hour. I'll tell you what, that was an emotional interview. I'll need some recovery time. I'll know you will too. Why don't we go to break with a wonderful Dorothy Moore track? This was sent to us by Mr. Larry Sanders. It's not a remix, but it's a wonderful. You'll get it. You people have hearts. Misty Blue.
Ooh, been such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby.
Across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential, a man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
Yeehaw. That's 877, the number 4, head on, 877-4-H-E-A-D-O-N. Also translates to 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, use that. It's area code 304-658-3333, rings in West Virginia. And email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. Lord, the web has been... You know, this is the sort of story you just don't know exactly how to head into. Well, you can tell. You just don't know how to go there. But we might as well address the issue, and at least I can give you my comments on it. And I'd like you to meet Mickey Cantor. That's K-A-N-T-O-R, Mickey Cantor. And Mickey Cantor was the chairman of the Clinton-Gore campaign in 92. He has been a friend of the Clintons since in the 70s, let's say. Potentially 28 years. I think after 28 years, you
You come to know your fellow man after a friendship that lasts that long. He is also the Secretary of Commerce, or is the Secretary of, was for Clinton. And currently he is the advisor to Hillary for 08. Now, there was a videotape. It's been posted on YouTube, and it's recently been rediscovered of some of his remarks in the war room during the presidential election back when Gore Clinton did their thing in 92. I'm gonna quote it to you, and I have the audio. Mr. Cantor says, after a stack of papers arrives in the room showing current election results, or polling results, rather, for Indiana, Mr. Cantor exclaims, look at Indiana! Look at Indiana! 42-40! It doesn't matter if we win. Those people are shit. How would you like to be a worthless white nigger? Well, of course, that means poor people. At least that's one interpretation of it. You realize all these people are in the millionaire class. So I think maybe the key word here might be worthless, and white nigger may be the icing on the cake, so to speak. There is a huge controversy today. Mickey Cantor is up in arms, brother. He says, I've never used that word in my entire life, ever, under any circumstances, an angry Cantor told the Huffington Post. And by the way, you might wonder, well, I am bringing it up because it's been in the news today, and most of you have seen it. But I'm bringing it up, too, if the Clinton administration, there's suspicion that the Clinton administration at least used Obama's minister to say things that might damage the Clinton campaign. Why not have someone from the Clinton campaign potentially damage the Clinton campaign? It's just, you know, politics is really dirty, is it not? Which is, I guess, why I'm covering it. Now, the Huffington Post became intimidated, in my estimation. He said, Cantor said, let me give it to you. Cantor said, I've listened to the video, and you have it, and you can't tell me what I'm saying in that second sentence. You can't decipher that. Indeed, Mr. Cantor is insisting that what he said was, how would you like to be in the White House right now? How would you like to be in the White House right now? He's insisting that he said that rather than how would you like to be a worthless white nigger. The lawyer repeats, Cantor's lawyer says, he did not say that, he did not say that. And in fact, Cantor has not directly but pretty much verbally threatened the Huffington Post for the libel suit. He said he has his best libel lawyers to approach YouTube and Huffington Post and told Huffington Post they shouldn't even print his defense or the article because it would be the advancement of a non-story. And he told Huffington Post, I don't need to be defended. What you write, what you are doing is libel. And so he's accused him of libel and told him he's hiring the very best libel attorneys and insisting that, what he said was, What was it again? He insisted that he said, would you like to be in the White House now? Words that affect him. Here we go. Says he insists that he said in this sound clip, how would you like to be in the White House? Now, the reason that this is debated is because He, at the beginning of the sentence, he didn't really realize there was a camera in the room when he began his statement. Look at Indiana, look at Indiana, he said in great excitement. 42-40, it doesn't matter if we win, those people are shit. Okay. Oops! there's a camera in the room. Then he said in his bestest, teeniest, tiniest little whisper to George Snuffleupagus and the other family, other gentlemen standing there, how would you like to be a worthless white nigger? Now, I've listened to it multiple times. I've listened to it with good quality headphones. It happened to be a Sony model, a professional model I bought just for this show. Great headphones. I listened to it with by enhancing it through an audio processor. I tried to strip out as much background noise as I could. I've watched the video, both the clip that's circulating on the web. I've watched the YouTube. I've watched his lips as he mouthed the words as closely as possible. And I got to tell you, folks, the man said, how would you like to be a worthless white nigger? Very disrespectful to the state of Indiana, but in fact, disrespectful to poor people and insulting and hurtful to black people. But basically, he's saying that Indiana is a bunch of dupes, and it doesn't matter if we win there anyway. Those people are shit, he says. He doesn't debate that. Oh, he said that loud enough for the camera. It was only the whisper that he's debating. He's saying, you can't tell what I said, that last sentence. There's no way you can tell. Well, indeed, folks, you can tell. In fact, we're going to run some audio here, and I'll point out to the listeners that if you would like me to send you these audio clips so you, too, can put on your headphones and listen very, very closely, as I did for an extended period of time, you will, I think, come to the same decision. I'm willing to send because, you know, obviously your computer speakers may not reveal because he whispered. He didn't want anybody to know. And you could, in fact, I can even see on George Snuffleupagus is standing in a profile at that point in time. And you notice if you saw the video, George Snuffleupagus keeps his head down. He's like, oh my God, there's a camera here. I can't believe you're saying, how it remains hidden for so long. I don't know. But in any case, it's being brought out now. Isn't it just amazing how you can find dirt during an election that nobody ever, in any case, Bob has a clip there called Worthless White Nigger, and he also has a clip there called Worthless White Nigger Loop. Bob, would you run the first one, the Worthless White Nigger, please?
Look at Indiana. Wait. Look at Indiana. 4240. It does not have to be. Those people. How would you like to be?
Okay. Let me repeat that for you. Look at Indiana. Look at Indiana. 42-40. It doesn't matter if we win. Those people are shit. How would you like to be a worthless white nigger? Bob, run that same track again. Not the loop. The same track.
Look at Indiana. Wait. Look at Indiana. 42-40. You did not have to win. Those people are shit. How would you like to be?
I grew up in the South. I've heard the word nigger since I was a little bitty talk show host in diapers. I know what the word sounds like. I know what the word sounds like when it's whispered. God knows I've heard it whispered all my life. I further attempted to enhance the last sentence, which Mickey Cantor insists that he did not say, and I've looped it so that you can hear it. I believe it's looped 3 or 4 times. Reduce the background noise as much as possible. And I should warn Bob, this particular one is at a higher volume level than the first one. I boosted the volume and tried to limit the frequency band to boost the last sentence. And I just listen closely. Bob, run the loop, please. How would you like to be a worthless white nigger, was what you just heard. You may not be able to tell on your computer speakers, but as I said, if you'll send me an email to peter@headonradionetwork.com, it's very easy, peter@headonradionetwork.com, I'll be glad to email you these two tracks as attachments. Even if you have dial-up, you can get them. The audio loops, both tracks are extremely short, and they're not very large, and your dial-up account will receive them. For those of you who are listening via the podcast, well, by all means, email me too when you hear this over the next week or month or year. I'll have them. It's not like I, you know, all this stuff goes into an audio archive somewhere. The audio never goes away. Just drop me an email, peter@headonradionetwork.com, and I will be more than happy to send these to you. You too can put on your fancy Sony headphones, and you can listen very, very closely, and you can adjust your tone controls, and you will see that, in fact, Mickey Cantor said exactly what we're saying that he said. You know, why is this important? Well, it's important because of the close friendship between. And I'm not saying that Clinton is prejudiced against black folks. I'm saying that they're all multimillionaire bastards, is what I'm saying. And highly insulting. Just drop me a note. I'll send you the audio myself. And Lottie in the chat room points out the video is still active on YouTube if you'd like to see it. At least I think so. In any case, Bob, Lottie, if you'd send me the direct link to that video, I'll post it on today's calendar date. And people folks see the video. Preston, welcome to the show from Denver.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, it's good to hear from you, sir.
Thanks so much for that interview you had. That was really powerful. I appreciated that.
It was very powerful, and I was glad when we sometimes tease him and call him Frozy, when Gene called from Oregon, because quite frankly, I had gotten a little shaky. My voice was shaky. I had some tears in my eyes. In fact, Gene from Oregon saved me by coming on and talking to him for a while I regained my composure. Well, when he was speaking of torture.
Great. He mentioned the outside money. He kept mentioning the outside money that's trying to guide the church in a reactionary, authoritarian direction, and I may have missed it, but did he specify where he thought the money was coming from? Was it just from like the Scaife Foundation, or is it someplace else as well?
That too, and the someplace else you could technically say was within the church, meaning that it's the Board of Regents for Southern Methodist University. Preston, it's a who's who. A very high-level, very wealthy, plugged-in and highly connected, friends of the family, exchange birthday presents, go on boating trips, help him clear brush, oil executives, and the like. Hunt is one of the primary ones. Ray Hunt from, what was it, the oil company that Bush used to play with? Yeah.
I think
he's one of them.
Like the Hunt brothers, weren't their brothers,
yes.
I think?
Okay. Yes. Yes, and there's that's only the tip of the iceberg. The entire Board of Regents the best way I can put it to you is just infested with them. Very high dollar, very conservative, in it for the money, let them eat cake, Republicans. And this thing about the library coming has been discussed at that level between those very, very wealthy people and Rove and Cheney since 2002. It was all a wired, done deal, and carefully concealed, I might add, from the faculty and from the students and the alumni and especially from people who go to Methodist churches. And that's where the money's coming from. It's not part of the money he was talking about.
Okay. A concealed money, you say?
Yeah.
Or a concealed effort, because they,
yes.
how unpopular they are. Interesting.
Yes,
I was also wondering if maybe, I don't know, parts of the government, I don't know, some security agencies or who knows who else is investing in it.
Good point.
You know, I remember Bill Moyers did a show about 15 years ago, 20 years ago maybe on PBS, and he talked about kind of like propaganda operations being conducted via churches in Latin America, and they preach to the poor kind of a don't worry about this world theology, you know, maybe in your next life God will treat you better, to try to divert them away from organizing and mobilizing against the injustices they saw in the world.
And well said, Preston.
Yeah.
Well said. And in fact, the backdoor operation is very typical of the Bush crime family and the legions and the hordes of demons that follow them, because they always attempt to come in the back door or insinuate themselves or get in such a way that nobody notices, and all of a sudden, poof, they've taken over because no sane person lets them in the front door. They have to do it this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so many of their policies, they manufacture consent through a kind of stealth language. They'll put forth their alleged agenda. For example, they're always talking about, well, we want choice and competition in the schools. Choice and competition. Sounds great, right? But they don't talk about their latent agenda, which you find when you read these, reports from the World Bank that estimate if you can privatize the globe's public school systems, there's, $3 trillion in extra revenue for various firms, to make. They've got to privatize everything so they can trade wealth, basically.
Well said. That's about the best I've heard it put. It is about how much money the corporation, and never about the individual. And Social Security is the same way. Privatize it, not because it helps anybody.
Right. That's right. Concentrate the wealth and also break the teachers' union, which they can't stand. Some workers out there have some protections, and some decent benefits, maybe. No, they can't stand unions. I'm fortunate to be in one because it got me on a mailing list of, a couple good, not great, well, a few good union efforts, to maybe do a little newsletter or whatever, and I've got to learn about some of McCain's positions on labor, which are so rarely discussed. And they're so reactionary and anti-union. People really, again, he would not be a popular person. They have to sell him on these kind of feelings, and he's a hero, and he's a real American kind of thing. Avoid policy at all costs. Serious discussion of policies, because they are elitist. And oftentimes Clintons are, and also Obama's, sadly. But certainly more so the right-wingers. I guess Obama, we were talking about the Latin American churches and how they're mobilizing people and they posed a threat to the elites in Latin America. And they were concerned about liberation theology, and people like Archbishop Romero were practicing it and speaking for the poor and justice. And this one bishop in Brazil famously said something like, "When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why are the people poor, they call me a communist."
Wow.
Yeah.
That's priceless. Glad you shared that.
Yeah. And so I think it very much leads to what's going on here now in this country. Black liberation theology has come up. And although this controversy, I'm sure, hurts Obama among many voters, I'm so glad that this controversy has taken place, because this voice is out there and generally very politically astute and spiritually astute ways. People want to knock him for the Q&A period during his press conference, and that's when Obama distanced himself from it. Jeremiah Wright as well. But I think generally the guy's speaking the truth. And the way he's being attacked, it's very reminiscent of how Ward Churchill was attacked here. He's a professor. Do you know him?
No, but I'm very interested in hearing the story.
Mm. Well, he wrote a very controversial essay, something like When Chickens Come Home to Roost, the day after 9/11 occurred, the attack.
Oh, yes. Vaguely familiar now. Yes, I read all of it, but I did not read it.
And the media came down on him like a ton of bricks, very much in the same manner that Jeremiah Wright's being treated in the media, with a particular loop of certain remarks, some that were objectionable, some not put very gracefully. some I don't agree with. But again, generally speaking, they're both making very important points. But they focus us on the, you know, the term, the phrases that can be, you know, maybe don't reflect so well. Like the AIDS suggestion, you know, he's being dismissed as a kook. But
yes.
And we can disagree with that theory. I don't know myself. But we do know much of our history of experimentation on African American and other vulnerable communities. That's not even.
Yes, we do. In fact, I would very much there's a fellow who's a highly educated and well researched individual who and has clearly placed it with hepatitis vaccines that they were in New York regarding the beginning of the AIDS crisis, and I would like to have him on the show to discuss it because I'm not qualified to do it. I'm still trying to find a way to track him down. But let me just say that people shouldn't be laughing at that theory. There's a lot of credible research behind it, actually.
Yeah, it's, and whatever it is, it remains a mystery, whatever is causing it. There's a lot of different angles on it. I've heard of possibly a contaminated virus, or a contaminated vaccination for polio in Africa. Have you heard that one?
Have not heard that one, but yes, the thing about the vaccinations, it's very similar. Yeah.
And then, you know, we've got large parenting and mainstream family groups and medical associations, some of which are complaining about vaccinations we give children all the time. Apparently some vaccines have lead in them. And that's why some people think so many children have autism these days.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the way they frame it, it's always, he said this. And they're just trying to teach us how to think. Dismiss it out of hand. Don't have an actual discussion about anything. Just dismiss it. It's training us to be dismissive. And again, it was kind of disappointing to see, you know, Obama distance himself from it. You know, I understand it kind of politically, but, you know, it's disappointing when Clinton distanced herself as well. You know, I would have left that church or whatever. Well, that would have been your loss. But
good point, Preston. And, and you can't blame the black church has been the community for black people for so many years. It was really their own, the only, they weren't allowed in the white communities. So it was like their home. It was like a family. And sure, they talked about the white people of those churches and how they were treated. Wouldn't you?
Definitely. And so many of the right-wing ideologues are trying to make this false analogy. They'll say, well, if McCain was in a white centric church, you know, we'd be flipping out, and if he was pushing white values and the white family and so on and so forth. Hannity repeats that argument constantly, and he gets to just say it over and over. No one gets to really confront him on it, on the logic of it. And what he's doing basically is saying, you know, he's leaving out the context, the political context, because if we went to a place like apartheid South Africa, and if we saw there were black churches mobilizing black families and we're suspicious of the white community, we'd understand that. And if at the same time there are white churches in apartheid South Africa pushing a white agenda, we'd be offended by it because of the power relations going on, the oppression and the constant jailings and the disparities in wealth and property and on and on and on. So basically what Hannity is doing is putting forth the argument of apartheid South Africa. And we've got very much the same situation. We're not like apartheid South Africa. In fact, in some ways, it's not by all measures, certainly. In many ways, we're not like apartheid South Africa. In some ways, we're worse. If we look at jailings, for example, we jail our African-American population at a rate higher than the worst period of apartheid South Africa jailing.
Good point. And per capita, we have, of any civilized nation, we have more of our citizens in jails and prisons than any other country, even China. Yeah, we do.
Yep. So
we're privatizing that.
That's right. Good point. That's right. That's right. And sometimes using the people inside as cheap labor.
Yes.
I read this anecdote about a guy who lost his job here in the U.S. at a factory. I think it was in Oregon. And it went to Mexico. And, you know, I hired the sweatshop workers. The guy who was unemployed turned to petty crime, ended up, you know, after cashing or pushing some bad checks, stuff like that, ended up in prison. He got his job back while he was in prison because the company found that even cheaper than the sweatshop labor, they could move back to the U.S. and put to work the U.S. prison population for even less. Then he ended up doing the same job.
Yes. Yes, and the private prison outfits are making quite a lot of money. And there's a lot of profit. You wouldn't think so, but there's a lot of profit.
Yeah.
And you can rip the government off on meals, like Halliburton is, or Kellogg Brown Root is, regarding the soldiers. There's so many ways.
Yeah. And you could argue, you know, that prisoners should be learning some skill or doing something, and sometimes they want to be occupied somehow. And that, again, if they can be supplied the jobs on the outside to begin with, we don't have so many on the inside who need stuff to do, and with no chance of forming unions and getting paid 30 cents a day or whatever.
Exactly. It's a permanent underclass, and it's a way of just housing them. But McDonald's isn't going to cut it. There's no way you can support a family. And the people that acknowledge that to themselves, what have you got but crime or selling drugs?
Yeah. You know, for the first time in a while, I heard the voice of somebody on food stamps on the media. And it was a person who called in to C-SPAN during one of their shows, and they had a reporter from the Washington Post who specializes in agriculture policy. And he seemed kind of, he wasn't particularly, what's the word, progressive or hard-hitting himself. But he seemed like a fair enough guy and open to suggestions for stories. And this woman called up. She was on food stamps, and I guess the Department of Agriculture handles that program. And the crumbs that people are given and the constant cutting of whatever they get, and the new regulations on if you can even get the crumb, and
that's so true. My sister actually has been involved in social service for since she started her career. She's just a few years younger than me, and has done everything from directing a Meals on Wheels organization to working it regarding Alzheimer's and a resource center, and she's been very involved, let's put it like that. So she knows her way around helping people to get food stamps or other assistance. And she has told me, quite frankly, that in the training for these state employees, or in some cases county employees, who are charged to assist low-income people or to help them work their way through the system, they are not trained to do that. They are trained to, in any way possible, disqualify the person from receiving the service. That is what their job is. Their job is not to help you, and it is not to refer you to another agency that could help you. It is to make you go away.
Yep. Yep. What a shame.
Yeah.
What a shame. And, boy, there are these guys on the radio. Entitlement. How dare they think they're entitled at all?
I know it.
Meanwhile, they're dispatching an army of lobbyists and, you know, agents to procure as much as they think they're entitled to. Amazing. So anti the Christian ethic, you know. Care for the least among us and that thing, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, lastly, before I let you go, I was listening to your clips that you were playing.
Yes.
And I had heard them earlier, actually. Ed Schultz had played it. And I really am having a hard time hearing it. And I'm certainly going to, I think I have a copy of that DVD here somewhere. Or I might try to find it on Netflix or whatever.
Yeah.
And
well, I'll be glad to send you the MP3s. Press, just drop me a note at Peter at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, so I'll have your reply address, and I'll send them right out later this evening.
Peter at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com.
And when I get that mail after the show, I'll just send it's just two little attachments. They're less than 500K a piece, the two that ran on the air. And if you have headphones on, it's like a little tiny microscope, and you can hear exactly what he's saying.
Okay. And I don't know. I'm concerned about this because I see another big argument developing between different factions of the Democratic
yep.
Party. And I'm wondering, where are these stories? What are their origins? You know what I mean? Like,
therein lies the question, Preston. That's the million-dollar question, sir. Yes, the origin.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, who's been combing through the Jeremiah Wright sermons and fishing out particular lines? And by the way, when Bill Moyers played the extended versions of those sermons, man, it was so powerful. And in fact, I thought for a couple of days there, I was hoping this is all going to be flipped around by Obama, you know, and just say, you know, don't try to shy away from him and view him as this albatross around your neck, this liability. This guy's an asset. He's an asset. He's been one for Obama for 20 years, his family, that community. Now he can be one for the entire nation. And there's so much of what he was saying that could have been used that way.
But well, yes.
Who's controlling the discussion, though? Who's picking what? Who's telling us what sort of attitude to have around it? Even lots of progressives now are saying, oh, my gosh, he's an egomaniac. How could he do this? So on and so forth. I'm like, what are you looking at?
Yeah, well, he may be an egocentric person, and he may have been able to present it better. But no matter what you say to discredit the man, he cannot deny that he has his ear close to the people.
Yeah. And exactly, he may be an egomaniac. That is, he may have those flaws, those human flaws that we all do, and we all say stupid things, and we all say comments that oftentimes we wish we hadn't made or that people point out to us that we shouldn't have made. And it can be an awkward, embarrassing thing, but we all go through it. And I hope that, you know, if we're dismissing him or Ward Churchill or so many others for these moments, then in a way I guess we're going to be dismissing ourselves ultimately because we do it too. And you know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
Like this Cantor, if all we know about him is this remark, which I may very well hear it when I listen to your MP3s, I trust that I will. He's so much more than that. Apparently, he was very much involved with civil rights legislation.
Oh yes, okay. Yes, he was, and to his credit, he was, and to his credit too, he said that at a time that he thought he was amongst just the inside core group, and it was, you know, it was never his intention to say that publicly. And it was probably, I have said things all my life, Preston, that you know, I intended to be funny, but could be taken another way. In fact, I love innuendo.
Yeah.
I don't think I would innuendo the way he did it, but, yeah. But nonetheless, yeah, we're all human, and it's maddening to see the, how we discredit people when they're only human, yet we ignore the monster in the White House. We ignore it, except for us. You know, but the mainstream media will ignores it. But everybody else has to be perfect. It's maddening.
Yeah, and we're undercutting, community that could be being built, or solidarity, or points of commonality that could be exploited. And, ways in which, I don't know, we could be learning things and from each other, instead of just, firing away at each other all the time. And, Hillary Clinton as well. And I'm the first one to critique policy she's been involved with or associated with, or her husband. In fact, I think some of the more substantial critiques haven't really been put forth. I mean, there was like 2 weeks on her, the circumstance of her landing in Bosnia 12, 13 years ago. A country, by the way, I don't think I would have wanted to be landing in personally, because we had so demolished that country with the bombing. And, all the sniper fire talk. There wasn't sniper fire yet, but, there was 80 days of this massive bombing we inflicted on that country. And so to fly in the corkscrew method or whatever they had to do, that part of it probably was kind of creepy. And I'm glad she wasn't actually being shot at, but it probably wasn't a fun landing in some ways. That's my suspicion. But anyway.
Yes, that's a very good point. There was a whole rigmarole about her saying she was under fire.
Yeah.
And the Republicans, and you contrast it. Mind-boggling, isn't it, Preston?
Yeah, and there's the much more, the deeper issues, the issues that implicate all of us, actually. I think that's part of the reason why sometimes we're almost eager to just pin it on other people, because, that bombing, that was all of us. That was our tax dollars. That was, members of our family who are in the military, or in the Navy, pushing the buttons, sending off the cruise missiles and all this stuff. And, we still have these companies like DynCorp, one of these private military companies that had a whistleblower within the company that exposed that DynCorp was running this child sex ring in Yugoslavia. And you can go on, and Clinton, the use of cluster bombs. I mean, that's a harsh criticism of Hillary Clinton, and that's the sort of thing that I think progressives should be getting mobilized on, not writing and just mocking notes to her about, no sniper fire, but writing her office and saying, we're offended that you voted to continue the use of cluster bombs. Obama voted against the use of cluster bombs. That's a big difference right there, and a substantial one. And, that kind of real policy discussion is being, the ways in which we're being intentionally diverted away from that stuff, it's really irritating, I must say. The public relations industry and some people in the media, it's the synchronicity with which they have these agendas working. It's really remarkable at times.
Well, Preston, I really have to hand it to you. You have an amazing, almost uncanny ability to remain centered, for lack of a better way to put it, to view things objectively. I know I don't always, because I think part of it is I see too much, and I see it very quickly. No point explaining. But I admire you for the fact that you are able to remain centered and look at all of these, because they're priceless. These are things we need to hear, because sometimes so many times, the left is reactionary too.
Yeah, sure. So, well, I'm fortunate that I'm lucky that I, you know, so many things that I've been missing for a while, I've had some people try to, I don't know, just look multiple sides, I guess, at things. I don't know.
Well, it's a gift, Preston. Not everyone can do that, but you have an honest and given knack for doing it. You do it so well.
Have you ever heard of a program called Alternative Radio by chance?
No, sir, I have not, but if you recommend it... Oh, and by the way, I got the movie and you recommended the other week. I haven't had a chance to see it yet. What was it? It starts with an H. Anyway, you mentioned the radio show, and I digress because you're recommending something else. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that the things that you tell me about to watch or listen to are always just amazing.
Glad you gotten something out of that stuff. And yeah, there's just that's another thing. I mean, so often we're angry about the situation of the media, myself as well, but there's this other part of the media that's just so great. Yeah, actually Ed Schultz recommended, I didn't know that Bill Moyer's interview with Jeremiah Wright was coming, and just watching stuff like that. I mean, Bill Moyers, what an incredible media teacher he's been. And I just got to watch Phil Donahue actually in an interview with a guy named Frank Boyd on C-SPAN, and oh my gosh, it was just and he stayed very, Phil Donahue has stayed very centered, and he's taken all kinds of heat because he worked with Ralph Nader for his 2000 campaign, and, you know, they got all that grief. And, you just see this pattern of a while, how we're constantly being told to hate one or another progressive person or liberal person, or, just resent everybody and think the worst of them and know how they're messing up everything or hate America or whatever. That's the red flag every single time. I'm like, now why am I supposed to hate this person now? And who would push this sort of agenda?
You're right, Preston. And I can use myself as an example. People resist that. People resist that listening and asking those questions because it takes work. One has to sit down and listen and put myself in their shoes and approach it from, whereas to just react, I hate those people, are all so stupid. It's very easy. It's quick. It's easy. You're done.
Yeah.
It's like fast food, you know. Yeah. To condemn is like fast food, and I can imagine that in your life, doing what you do and speaking the way you do, you've probably come to that same conclusion.
Yeah. And the techniques are so, you know, sometimes people say, the techniques are so sophisticated too. More so all the time. Sometimes very blatant, sometimes very subtle. Sometimes we just grow up on these kind of prejudices that they entrench in our minds. I was thinking just the other day, I think yesterday was May Day. And May Day around the world is this celebration of international solidarity. But in this country, it's been, it has this negative connotation. It became this word of warning, you know? I can think of all, like, these military, 50s, 60s, 70s military movies where the plane is in distress and you're yelling, Mayday, Mayday! And I really don't think that's just a coincidence. I really think that there's some PSYOPs person, some info warrior in the FBI or some other institution that's like, how do we connote something negative about this International Workers Solidarity Day? And we're going to turn it into this word of warning and fight against that fear button that is constantly pushed.
Very interesting that you bring that up, because in the United States yesterday was the National Day of Prayer. And the National Day of Prayer is at this point, it wasn't intended to be back in 1952, but Reagan had an effect on it, and Bush has had a huge effect on it. It's now a wholly owned subsidiary of Focus on the Family. And the National Day of Prayer is basically a be afraid, be very afraid day, because you're supposed to pray for the military and the constant threats to the country and that our leaders will be able to defend us and all the things that keep everybody just a little bit rattled. And you just have to, you know, why May 1st? And this May 1st date was not set back in 1952. It was just, there should be a National Day of Prayer. It was George W. Bush himself who firmly said it in concrete that this is the day. But one wonders about the psychops, as you say, even to the level of when the National Day of Prayer is. This is uncanny.
I think there it is. In fact, I saw a photo of Dobson speaking. I don't know if it was National Prayer Day event, but behind him was this huge banner, and it said something about the defense of marriage. The colors of the banner were black and red, which is completely black and red is the color of that's been used on flags and banners of these workers' movements around the world.
Interesting. I never would have put that together.
Yeah. Black is more associated with anarcho-syndicalism, labor organizing, and questioning authority, and the red is, of course, the communist part. And so there's Dobson on the stage, you know, mobilizing, and he's got this black and red banner behind him. And, they see these movements developing, the right wing does, the elites. They don't like popular movements, and they, you know, in addition to trying to smear leaders or, you know, they assassinate people like Archbishop Oscar Romero and others. And but they also do the smear character assassination, and then they also do co-optation of movements and try to take the energy of the discontent and the fear and, you know, people's longing for some sort of community in a struggle oftentimes, and they put it into these defensive marriage movements, or, you know, defend ourselves from the gays and the immigrants and the Muslims, instead of, you know, going after what popular movements usually go after, and that is, you know, breaking down these concentrations of both resource, wealth, and decision-making power in society. You know, democracy, basically.
Yeah, you know, democracy. Well done. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I have to stop and laugh there. Yeah, you know, democracy. Cool. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, cool. I'm glad I got a chance to catch up with you.
I am too.
That's a great interview. Do you have your stuff on? Is it all on pods, or do you do MP3s for your show? Or is it
sure do. They're available either by going to strictlyconfidentialradio.com. strictlyconfidentialradio.com always has a calendar there on the home page, and you can look within any calendar date and see who the guest was, and the link to the audio archive is right there, so it makes it handy if you want to know which guest you're looking for the archive for. Or you can go to White Rose Society, and that is its archive. It's there listed by date. strictlyconfidentialradio.com site just organizes it by who was on, makes it easy. Yes, it's MP3. Click and listen.
Okay. Thank God. And I, you know, I'm not real familiar with pods, but is there if I wanted to forward it, I just that's a pretty simple process, I imagine.
Your player, most players, as you listen to it, or once you've completed listening to it, you can use file save.
Okay.
And file save, different players configure it differently. Some are more of a mystery than others, but the way it should be, if everything were standardized, you would always click file save and you'd have the MP3. But if you're unable to save the MP3 and forward it, you could always just forward the home page or forward the site and tell them where to click, you know.
Okay.
Forward the link.
Yeah, I'm not very good at that stuff. Some computer stuff. I'm just happy I can stream radio every now and again, and my email's up and running, and I'm not bombarded with spam. I'm in good shape. So.
Yeah, sometimes it's the simple things that keep us sane.
yes, indeed. Well, all right. Well, enjoy your weekend, Peter.
Thank you, Preston. I always enjoy talking to you, and I know Bob does too. We've secretly whispered behind your back. you're always a remarkable caller and such depth. We appreciate you very much as a listener.
Well, thank you, both of you, for being out there for this great forum.
Thank you. Thank you, Preston.
Take care.
Good evening. And thank you, Preston. You have a great weekend too. Good night.
Thanks. Good night. Bye-bye.
And that, folks, is Preston from Denver, one of the most remarkable characters you're likely to meet on the Head On Radio Network, because he is such a kind, gentle soul, and certainly considers things, I think, more carefully. But, you know, thank goodness for people like that. It's we don't always listen to them, though, do we? We often go running right by them, obsessed with our own agendas, and I'm guilty of that. And anyway, thank goodness for Preston. What would we do without him? What would we do without any of our listeners? You all bring such a unique perspective to my show, and to Bob's show, and to Guy's show, and to John's show, and to all of the shows. So anyway, if you are a new listener, this is more of a Head On Radio Network family than anything else, and we will never rush you through, or we want to know what you think. We actually want to know what you think. In fact, what you think is far more important than what I think or what Bob thinks, because you could always listen to one of us ramble on, or what Guy thinks, and you know what we think, but it's always a treasured moment to hear what you think, because we don't always get a chance to do that very well, do we? What a week it has been. What a roller coaster of a week. I earlier today I was thinking, oh, I can't wait till it's Saturday. I could just watch a movie. I can do nothing, you know. But, you know, it's always funny. Bob and I have discussed this, too. It's when you're actually communicating with people and doing a show, it's a whole different thing. As soon as it's over, you miss it. So, in any case, interesting week. We had Sean Talpierre on Monday and Scott Hall on Wednesday. And we had a gay bar across the street segment scheduled for this evening, but we, of course, always defer to guests or callers. But we'll run that Monday. And the gay bar across the street segment is interesting because it was a mystery DJ. All of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky today, arrived a mystery DJ MP3, a mixed set. I have no idea. He said he referred to himself as Strick Lee. Get it, Strick Lee? His S-T-R-I-C-K, new word, Lee, as if the last name was Lee. Strick Lee, not for dancing, is the name of the mix. And it's always, we'll run it next week. And I need to tell you that there is no horn section this evening. It is actually already Saturday where John is, and John is enjoying his...